Again, this is now Wednesday, February 23. Is that correct? I believe it is. 23? Or is it 24? 23 or 4? Wednesday, whatever. One of those 2 days. And I think it must be 24. And we're looking on the handout that's got a strange title to it. It says Chem 422, Chapter 32, Supplemental Lecture Guide. We're on page 5, looking at the bottom where we have all these sharks, the botulism toxin. I'm not going to belabor the point, except to say that the take-home message from this is that one of the effects of these botulism and tetanus toxins is that it apparently attacks the proteins responsible for the synaptic vesicle attaching to its target on the plasma membrane. And the detail that, in other words, like SNAP25's attacked by botulinum toxin A&E, I'm not looking for that kind of level of detail. Just have a general knowledge that those specific synaptobrevin, synaptotagmin, syntaxin, and SNAP25 are targets for these botulism and other toxins. Going on to another subject on page 6, we see this is now a timed, this is a graph, a figure that illustrates the current that comes from, remember, the calcium channels, the voltage-gated calcium channels are opened, and the response that comes from that. So, if we take a look here, we see that it says the release of neurotransmitter vesicles is directly tied to the influx of calcium 2 ion into the region containing the vesicles. Extracellular ion concentration is typically, and what number do you think we should put in there if I was going to put in a single digit? What do you think? 1 millimolar. 1 millimolar. And this is only approximate. This is probably the range is going to be probably within a decade. I mean, a power of 10. Some people will say 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 millimolar. And then the baseline intracellular ion concentration, that's within the ion, within the cell, for calcium 2 ion concentration is about 1 millimolar. And probably go ahead and put that little squiggly line there in front to indicate approximately or about. Why is it in focus over here but not in focus over there? It makes no sense to me whatsoever. But at any rate, let's see if I can... Does that help any? Not much. That's probably about right. Okay, so we need to take a look at some things here. Just hold on. I want to double check some stuff because I have the numbers actually on a different chart. Let's see if I have the chart here. There it is. Okay. All right. So, so the rest of it is, so the postsynaptic response occurs 500 microseconds following the arrival of the action potential at nerve terminals. Calcium ion channels that allow calcium in the nerve to require about, and this is, put in the term, 300 microseconds to open. Now, some of these numbers don't add up exactly, but it's close. So don't expect perfection on something that is so rapid and so variable. This leaves about 200 microseconds for the vesicles to respond to the increase in calcium and fuse with the plasma membrane. 200. Now, so when it fuses, it still means that the neurotransmitter has to fuse out of the vesicle. Based on the time required for the calcium ion diffusion to take place, there must be, and here we go, this must be at least 10 calcium ion channels located within about 50 nanometers, put in 50 nanometers of any of the given vesicle. The calcium ion overlap, the coverage of the vesicles. Bind the calcium ion, the vesicle must occur very rapidly. And apparently it takes about blank calcium ions to bind to a vesicle before it will fuse. And it takes approximately 4 calcium ions. Four. All right. So you can see this in here. Looking at the figure called figure 10.7, we can see here where we've got the presynaptic action potential. That's the action potential that's flowing down the axon toward the bouton. Once it hits the bouton, you see we can see the action potential go up and down. We can see it depolarize. As it begins to depolarize in the region of the voltage-gated calcium channels, they begin to see a post. We see the calcium current increase as it moves into the interior of the cell from outside the cell. We see this rise in current. So there's a slight lag as a current begins to be generated. The calcium channel, voltage gated, opens and then shuts as the action potential arrives and then passes on. And so it opens and then shuts. And then you see whatever this means. Some sort of postsynaptic response. This is the response on the membrane adjacent to the synapsis. And so you can see here comes the presynaptic current. Here's the calcium channel opening and closing. There's a postsynaptic response. During this time, there's a voltage-gated ion channel. They open. The calcium streams into the region. The calcium channel triggers the fusion of the vesicle to the membrane, the release of the opening of the membrane, the release of the neurotransmitter, the diffusion of the neurotransmitter across the synaptic cleft, and then the subsequent postsynaptic response through some voltage-gated channel, through some voltage change. All right. A major fraction of the synaptic delay results from the slow opening, because there are faster opening voltage-gated channels in calcium, slow opening voltage-sensitive calcium channels. A further delay about 200 microseconds between the calcium influx and the postsynaptic response. Again, that comes from the diffusion of materials across the thing. All right. Well, what else can we say about the vesicles? Well, we know the vesicles are also released in quanta. In other words, that the response is measured and has a variety of things. Now, let's take a look. So this says vesicles are released in quanta. This is an experimental determination that we can make that statement. The quantum, if we were to measure the area underneath these responses, we would see that the area actually has some interrelationship. Right? So here's 10.5, and much of the information is buried in this caption. Caption contains the essence of what this problem, what this statement is. So we're going to read it aloud as you read along, so that we can maximize the understanding. Compares to the amplitudes of the spontaneous miniature end plate potentials and the evoked end plate potentials indicates that neurotransmitters released in quantal packages that are fixed in amplitude but variable in number. Ho-ho! In other words, that the first sentence really describes this. Now, there are spontaneous, which means what? What's the word spontaneous mean? Unprovoked, exact, just unknown. And then you have evoked. Now, what does evoked mean? Evoked, and this means artificially stimulated or externally stimulated. And indicated, all right, so let's see that. Let's see. You can see here where this marked time is where there is an external stimulus. And you can see that they've been measuring prior to that stimulus, and they would note that there's these little potentials that come through that were not stimulated. They're just sitting there going, doink, doink, doink. And so, in other words, there are stimuli that apparently are occurring randomly that are important. In other words, that when you're alive, even when you're dead asleep, there are stimuluses that occur. Right now, all of your muscles, because you're upright and sitting, are in tone, as it were. They have some tone to them. If you lifted your arm and relaxed it, it would drop, but it would not drop completely unimpeded because your muscles have some tone. When you're asleep, if I picked up your arm and dropped it, it would just be like you were dead. Boink. Indicating that there is no tone there. And so the tone comes from some constant low level of stimulation that's being evoked in your muscles because you are awake. That would be similar to the stimulus right here. When you're asleep, you have more tone than if you were dead, and that comes from those unanticipated, unevoked stimuli. A, intracellular recording from a rat nerve muscle synapsis shows a few spontaneous miniature end plate potentials and synaptic responses or end plate potentials evoked by 8 consecutive stimuli to the nerve. Stimulus artifact is evident in the records produced by current flowing between the stimulating and recording electrodes in the bathing solution. In a calcium deficient magnesium rich solution designed to reduce transmitter output, the end plate potentials are small and show considerable fluctuations. 2 pulses produce complete failures, and 2 produce a unit potential, and others produce responses that are 2 to 4 times the amplitude of the unit potential. Comparison of unit potential and spontaneous occurring potentials indicates that they are the same size. Now, this is interesting. In a calcium-deficient magnesium-rich solution designed to reduce transmitter output, in other words, what they've done is that they have isolated from tissues. They've isolated muscle, and you got this synaptic bouton. You got this nerve ending. And what they've done is, of course, clustered at the synaptic cleft are these hundreds and hundreds of vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. And, of course, you have the calcium channels that come in. If the calcium channels, what they've done is, under normal circumstances, if you have the calcium channel open, there are a considerable number of neurotransmitter vesicles that fuse and then are recycled. And then these vesicles are immediately regenerated. But in this case, because these materials have been taken out of the body, the rat body, these vesicles are not being regenerated at nearly the same pace, if at all. So if they allow the calcium ion concentration to be normal outside the cell, and they brought an end plate potential in, all the calcium that would normally run in, a bunch of vesicles would fuse, and the next end plate potential that would come through would have very few, if any, vesicles to work with. So what they've done is they've taken that calcium ion concentration way down on the outside. So when the end plate, when the potential comes through and these voltage-gated ion channels open up, only a few of the vesicles fuse. So that if you then have another end plate potential come through, there's still enough residual vesicles that they'll fuse again. And then more, another end plate potential, another to fuse, so that you can do multiple experiments on the impact of calcium coming in on a nerve muscle interface that's outside the body of a rat, because you're not fusing all the vesicles that you could. Does that make sense? Okay, so, yes?
So you said that they brought the calcium pipe, way down.
Right.
Is it down low and still just above that? Or is it way down low and it's pumped against it?
No, it is. It is lower, certainly, than normal, but it's still higher than what's in the interior. So there is a natural, it's a good question, natural influx of the calcium into the nerve end. So it's actually, the calcium is not lower than what's in the interior. All right, so what does this mean? All right, so they stimulate, and look at that. They get a postsynaptic response of a certain area. They stimulate, they have no response. And that's because, of course, they're not trying to find out what the maximum response is. They're trying to find out if there is a predictable response to it, and that's why they need to do multiple experiments on a single nerve bouton. And so this was a failure completely to have any kind of response. Here is the they could detect a spontaneous potential. Here is a stimulus. There's an area that's a unit. Here's a stimulus, a double that unit. Here's another unit, a failure, a double. So you end up realizing, when they've done this often enough, they began to realize that the area under the curve was multiples of the unit. In other words, that if you took this area and this area and compared it, this is double the area of the unit. And it's not, 2.685 times, it's 2. Or it's 3. Or it's 4. Or it's 1. Or 2. Or 3. Or 2. Or 1. Or 4. Or 3. And so that means that the neurotransmitter was being released in quanta, measurable small packets. So that confirmed that these vesicles that they see in the electron microscopes are in fact the packages of the neurotransmitter, and that they're released and their effect is based on the number that are released at a particular time. All right. Comparison, indicates that transmitters released in quantal packages that are fixed in amplitude but variable in number. All right. So, in other words, that if I was, may I shake your hand? This is going to be a limp fish shake. Barely any physical contact. And then you got this. Okay. It's the same action. How do I increase the intensity of the muscle? How do I get more of them? How do I get a stronger power? Well, I'm sending a nerve pulse down the nerve that's saying, all right, this limp fish is, limp fish handshake is a 1 unit. I really want to indicate confidence. I want a 3 unit. And so you just, and you start releasing power that way. Now, fortunately enough, it isn't like, it isn't like this. The nature of biology is random enough we don't have a quantal response to it. In other words, if I shake your hand, I don't have a 1 power, a 2 power, and a 3 power. Zero power, 1 power, 2 power. In other words, I have a continuously variable power, but that simply means that the number of neurotransmitter molecules I'm releasing, while they are released in quanta, there's sufficient numbers of them that, I can release 200,000, or I can release 210,000, or 230,000, or 240,000, and essentially get a continuous form of the power that can be released. At any rate, it's interesting. All right, page 8, ladies and gentlemen. Page 8. Now, this is a detail looking at V-snare, T-snare, NSF, snap, gap, cop, ARF, GEF. Woohoo! In other words, that we're now going back to the cell biology of release and targeting and binding of vesicles. Now, this is different than what you are expecting, because we've been talking about what's happening at the synaptic bouton, But this is an illustration between the ER and the Golgi apparatus. So this material over here, where it's not designated, is actually called ER, which is endoplasmic reticulum. And over here, this thing is a Golgi cisternae. And so, again, this is the details of this. They probably have amplified and increased since this figure has been made. But the general form of it, the typical names for it, are all standard. And so you'll be able to move with confidence into a cell biology question or whatever that uses this. Not surprisingly, the V-snare, let's see here. One of the reasons why I like this particular figure is that it defines these things very well. So this is figure 4.5, page 8. General mechanisms of vesicle targeting, docketing, and ER and Golgi. This accounts, they basically use the same terminology for the synaptic cleft as well, the vesicles and synapses. The assembly of the coat proteins. So the coat proteins in this case are called COPs. Coat, C-O-P, proteins. They're illustrated by these round dots that are around this vesicle. These coat proteins help form the vesicle, provide structure for this lipid membrane to be pulled away from the ER and formed into a vesicle. It's driven by what they call ADP ribosylation factors, ARFs. So you can see here this ARF that's got a GTP attached to it. The GTP is the ARF. The other dots that do not have the GTP are called the COPs. Okay. Is driven by ADP ribosylation factors in a GDP-dependent fashion. In other words, that when the ARF has GTP attached to it, it starts forming, initiating the formation of these vesicles. It's kind of like, remember how the G proteins are turned on when GTP is attached to it? It's not that GTP is necessarily using the energy. Is the energy form of it, but it's simply a trigger indicating, hey, I've got GTP here, form a vesicle. Dissociation of the coat is triggered when the hydrolysis of the GTP bound to the ARF is stimulated by a GTPase activating protein. So you got a gap right here. A gap is a part of, actually, somewhere, it's a part of the vesicle that gets built off of it. So this gap is called the GTPase activating protein. It's on the Golgi membrane, so it's actually not here. It's one of these things right here, Golgi membrane. So there's a gap and a T-snare. Let's see if I have this in color. Does it help any? No, it doesn't. Doesn't seem to. I think they're actually missing a diagram here. So what I want you to do for me, if you don't mind, is I want you to put a little box up here that's next to. This thing is called the T-snare. This thing is called the V-snare. I have it in lowercase. It's all written in uppercase otherwise. So it's the V-snare is on the vesicle, T-snare is on the target, and that other box I'm getting in here, that would I'm going to call that one called the gap. It's a part of the Golgi apparatus. I don't think it's shown actually, because the these right here. Are the T-snares. T-snare. It's all in caps because it actually means something, and we'll discover that a little bit later. All right, so the cycle of coat assembly and disassembly can continue when the replacement of the GTP on the ARF by GTP is catalyzed by guanine nucleotide exchange factor. That's this GEF. That GEF is right there. So the membrane formation or the vesicle formation is turned off when the ARF has a GDP attached to it, but that's exchanged with this GEF. So the GEF puts a GTP on that ARF again, and it stimulates it to begin forming another vesicle. There are lots and lots of vesicles being moved between the ER and the Golgi apparatus. So this is going to occur pretty much on a continuous basis. Fusion of the vesicles with their target membrane in the Golgi is regulated by a series of proteins. One of this N-ethylmalamide sensitive factor, NSF, the soluble NSF attachment proteins called SNAPs, soluble NSF attachment proteins, SNAPs, and their SNAP receptors called SNARES, which together assist the vesicle in docking with the target membrane. Snares on the vesicle, V-snares believed to associate with the corresponding T-snares on the target membrane. Now, interestingly enough, in other words, here's the experimental history of this. When they first began looking at the binding of the vesicles to a membrane, they were trying a variety of compounds to see if they could disrupt it. And they discovered that if they put in N-ethylmalamide in this process, they could disrupt the binding. They eventually did enough experimentation, and somebody got their PhD out of it, maybe a couple people. They discovered that there was a protein that was sensitive. That was the protein. They discovered one protein sensitive to that particular material. And so they identified that protein as being the N-ethylmalamide sensitive factor. And then they call it NSF. And then they discovered that there were other factors that assisted the NSF in the attachment. They called them soluble NSF attachment proteins, SNAPs. And then they got the SNAP receptors called SNARES. Somebody was being too cute by half, but it was fun for a while. And so you've got the NSF and the SNAP all interact together, as you can see here. There's an interaction that plays out. See, there's the SNAP and that NSF site. This is the NSF. And this triangle right here is the SNAP. So you have the SNAP and the NSF that together associate and help fuse the vesicle to the T-snare, the V-snare and the T-snare. And after they're fused, and after they bind and fuse, these soluble factors release and go on to redo it again. So you should be able to tell me at least a little bit of a story that goes on with this diagram from memory. What I'm going to try to do is see if I can get a color copy of this. This would be helpful. I'll try to get that to you on Friday. If I can't, this is still okay. You're going to be able to understand it just fine. Now, last overhead, I believe, on this particular section is page 9. Is that correct? This particular one has a lot of interesting aspects to it. This is dealing with, it's got a variety of things here. It doesn't necessarily deal specifically with the action that's occurring at the synaptic bouton. It's dealing with the actions of carrying things to the synaptic bouton. If you recall, vesicles are carried, empty vesicles are carried from the cellular body, cell body, all the way down the axon, all down the axon to the synaptic cleft, and these vesicles are empty. How do they get carried? Who carries them? What's the motive force? And so this is a diagram that illustrates this. And so it also adds some new information as well. there are motors in your body. Did you know that? Motors. Motors more than just the actin, myosin filament that's in your muscles. There are other kinds of motors that move things. And let's just quickly go through what this is talking about. Dynines and kinesins. Dynine and kinesins are molecular motors. They actually, during the hydrolysis of ATP, they move on, actin filaments. They move on actin filaments in response to the presence of ATP. And I want to make sure I get this right. One of these is incorrect. I want to make sure I get this right. I don't have it in here, do I? No, I don't. Typical. Right here. You see where it says right to left? It should be left to right. This right in here, this caption figure, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down, you should change that. Right to left and left to right. Do you have this? Okay. So you can do that. Okay, change it. That's how you indicate whenever you're doing any kind of editing, if you want to switch two words, you do this. Up and down like that, and that tells the person who's looking at it to switch the editing around on it. Now, so the cell body is actually up here. This is the cell body, is over here. And then you've got the synaptic bouton is down here. Synaptic bouton. Down here. All right. Well, so you got the dynines and the kinesins, and depending on which direction they go, they're named one way or the other. You got the synaptic vesicle, a precursor, your sodium channel, transport vesicle, sodium channel, retrograde vesicle. You've got phosphatases with a capital P, they're active, capital lowercase p, they're inactive. You got kinases, capital K, they're active, lowercase k, they're inactive. Which is what that means here. And so, if you look right in here, in this region where the node of Ranvier, or en passant synapse, in other words, a little projection, that's French for, I have no idea, anybody know French? What's en passant mean? Passant? In passing? Could be, yeah. A synapsis in passing. That comes off, and so this is a dendrite from another nerve that touches this section. Of course, here you see what kind of cell is this that's got the nucleus and the entire body is wrapped around the nerve? What kind of glial cell is that? What is it? This is a Schwann cell. Schwann, capital S, Schwann cell. And then you got your node of Ranvier and so on. Let's go ahead and take a look at some of the details here. You can see a cluster of capital P's and lowercase k's versus a cluster of capital K's and lowercase p's. Obviously, you would want one on while the other is off. So you notice right in here, during this region where the node of Ranvier is and where this synaptic piece is also, there are capital P's right here, which indicate what's happening when there's a capital P and lowercase k. What's happening here? The phosphatases are turned on and the kinases are turned. So that means that somewhere in this region there is a variety of processes that are going on in which they're controlled by the level of phosphorylation, and the level of phosphorylation is decreasing in this region where the synaptic cleft is, signaling certain things to occur that are necessary at that node. You can see away from the node of Ranvier, you can see where the K's are now capitalized and the P's are lowercase, indicating these are kinases, telling the various, giving a signal. And there's more signals than just the phosphatases and kinases, but this is one thing they do know about. Telling them that other processes to shut down and certain processes to turn on because you're not near a node of Ranvier. So here you've got actin filament, and you can see here where these kinesins, the kinesins right here, are molecular motors that, as you know, actin filaments are polar. There's a plus end and a minus end. Now, which end is which? I'll be frank, I don't know from this drawing. I'm simply going to arbitrarily say that this is a plus end and a minus end. These are not charges. It's simply saying that the structure of this actin filament is different from one end to the other. I can tell that this end is different than this end. It's kind of like with amino acids. We can tell the C-terminus end from the N-terminus end. Is that correct? Yeah. Well, in the same way, actin filaments have the end, one end is different than the other end. And it would be consistent throughout this whole process in which the plus end and the minus end are always oriented in the same way throughout that synaptic region. And what happens is the kinesins are essentially the same kind of motor, except they're designed, like for example, these kinesins are designed to move toward the minus end of the actin filament, which would mean it would move toward the synaptic bouton, whereas the dynes are designed to move on those same actin filaments, but move the other way, move toward the positive end. And so these two motors, depending on how they're activated, will move materials toward the synaptic bouton, or if it's a different motor, away from the synaptic bouton. The moving away from the synaptic bouton is called a retrograde motion. So toward it is called anterior grade. Away from the bouton is called retrograde. And so there are vesicles that are full of, they're empty, they're moving toward that region. There are vesicles moving away from that region that are carrying degraded byproducts and other things away from the synaptic bouton. They all use the highway known as actin, but depending on the motor, will give them which direction is which. All right, and let's see here. All right, so. These are neurofilaments, these kind of things right here called neurofilaments. The idea here is, again, that given in the region of the node of Ranvier, the relative proportion of activated and deactivated phosphatases and kinases changes, which signals the carriers of these materials to either drop off a load or pick up a load, or continue to move on or bypass this region. And so we don't know exactly what triggers the changes in the activity of these phosphatases and kinases, but they are relevant in that area. So I would like for you, and I'm not going to do it here, but I need for you to read and assimilate this process. Read and assimilate. Now, assimilate is a fancy word for learn it. I think there's two A's. Assimilate, read and learn. I think it's A-S-S-I-M-I-L-L-A-T-E, I think is assimilate. I don't think there's two M's in assimilate, is there? Okay. At any rate, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you, I don't have it here because I haven't created it yet. I just thought about doing it right now because I don't want to spend time going over this. I'm going to give you a series of questions that are going to ask you that will determine, help you, force you to read this is essentially what that is. And you're liable to see that on the test coming up. Now, today is Wednesday. Now, this is the last day for the test. Is that correct? Okay, information on this. All right, so What time is it? So the test ends right here. Okay? We are going to go on, but the test ends right here. And in the next few days, we'll try to figure out exactly where the test begins, but we know the test ends, and it ends right there. All righty then. We're moving right along. We'll soon be getting into the actual neurotransmitter section of this in just one more handout. What? Are there any questions? All right. Now, you guys have driven me to drink. Oh, okay, hold on. We've actually got two more handouts specifically. Let's take a look then. I don't know. This doesn't matter what order this is. Did everybody get this handout, this thing right here? There's some right here. And it says responses of postsynaptic cells to neurotransmitters. We'll do that not now. We are not doing it now. We have one other thing to do, and that is you should have a handout that's entitled General Mechanisms of Vesicle Targeting, Protein Details. Do you have that? There should be some blanks in it. Okay. Do I have an extra one of these? Hold on. I have my original. Should I give up my original? What? No. Don't stop by later. I should have a copy on my computer. You're welcome. Anybody else need one? Because I could have. All right. So, okay. All righty then. Now then, when you get to grad school and so on, all this stuff is going to be a part of some of your process. So this is actually like a history of this stuff. So we'll quickly go through this. There's a tremendous amount of detail in here. Not all of it is going to be crucial for your edification. I'm going to put a check mark by the stuff I need for you to know. Now, I need you to know what NSF stands for. What does it stand for? That's exactly correct. The clearness of that was outstanding. How do you pronounce this word? Malamide or malamide, right. N-ethyl mal or male. I've heard of male or mal. Malamide or malamide. Malamide. So there's some question about the exact pronunciation of it, but when you hear it, you'll know exactly what it means. It was originally, when I put a check mark by something, I'm liable to ask a question about it. Okay, so it was originally discovered in CHO cells called Chinese hamster ovary cells. Have you ever heard of CHO cells before? These are very, Chinese hamsters are, they honestly, they their ovary cells are very easily harvested without harming the animal. So, and they're big. They're big. They're giant cells, so they're very easy to work with. It's a soluble homotetramer, and it's found in the cytosol around the Golgi apparatus. Okay. All right. So a homotetramer. What's a homotetramer? Four subunits that are the same. And originally discovered after storing vesicle transport in an in vitro system and activated with NEM. Guess what NEM is? Yes, N-ethylmalamide, malamide. Okay. Now then, so if active factor is inactivated by that malamide, vesicle transport between cisternes is blocked. unfused vesicles transport. Also implicated in the aortic Golgi apparatus. It appears to catalyze vesicles or attachment infusion part of a 20S membrane associated. The little exclamation point you don't have to recall from memory. I just want to point something out to you. It says 84% identical sequence of the SEC18 gene product of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is a yeast. Two proteins to be true homologs. This is the point that I want to make about this that you don't have to write down, but it's a warning to you, and that is. Much of the cell biology that you're going to be dealing with as biochemists is very kind of tricky, because what happens is different groups, scientific groups, work with different organisms in their labs. One group may work with Chinese hamster ovary cells. Another group might work, in this case, with yeast. All right. What this means is when they find a protein that does the same thing, but in one species versus another, they don't call it the same thing. They call it something else. In other words, that it's a rare thing for you to see NSF to be labeled in two or more different species. They're going to call the protein something else, even though it has the exact same process and purpose. That's why I put this exclamation point. In other words, one group will call their product that does this called a SEC18 gene product. Another group, since they're working in Chinese hamster ovaries, will call it NSF. Another group that might work in a different species may call their protein NSF-like, -like, L-I-K-E. So it quickly descends into this morass of where you may have four or five names for a similar protein doing a similar thing, but in four or five different species. So just be aware of that as you read through this stuff. All right. Okay, the NSF binds specifically in a saturobilable manner to Golgi apparatus membranes. That means if it binds in a saturatable manner, that means there's some sort of limiting receptor. There's a certain maximum number of receptors it binds to. Now, the details here, the binding requires some sort of integral receptor. Now, this integral receptor means that integral means membrane bound. And then the soluble NSF attachment proteins, the SNAPs, we've already been introduced to those before. And then here's some operational information. Once it bound to the Golgi apparatus, can be released with the addition of ATP and MG. But to note this, but not remember it necessarily. It's interesting. Also, NSF and SEC18 are irreversibly activated if these things are not present. Notice again, NSF and SEC18 behave the same way, are clustered the same way, have the same protein homology and so on, but they're not both called NSF Chinese CHO or NSF Cerevisiae. I need to figure out how to pronounce that one. I am struggling with how to pronounce. I'll have to talk with Dr. Chobotar about how to pronounce that. At any rate, so they act the same, behave the same, but they're named differently, which is kind of very confusing to us chemists who, of course, same. You do the same thing, you name it the same thing. All right, so let's see here. So, binding requires that integral protein, soluble attachment factors, Also because a complex with NSF is formed of the following members, independent of ATP hydrolysis, that integral membrane receptor, which is that thing, NSF, which is this up here, alpha snap or beta snap. So basically, this is an expansion of what this thing is. And notice it says soluble NSF protein, attachment protein snaps. The snaps come in variety of flavors. There's a gamma snap, an alpha snap. This should be, and I missed the correct thing, that should be a beta snap. A beta snap. And I need to go. Oh, is it printed correctly on yours? Well, lucky you. Okay, so we stopped right here today. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And we will see you on Friday. And hopefully, again, I am actually working on grading all this stuff. And I'm making actually pretty good progress. And so you should have some stuff in your boxes by Friday. Yes, please do. I'll take it right now. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. The future of farming. Interesting. Take care, Brittany. See you later.